You are listening to EMS 2020, a podcast hosted by Spencer Oliver and myself, Chris Finkston. We are paramedics with quite a bit of experience, ranging from flight paramedicine to ground transportation to even some volunteer work as well. EMS 2020 reviews scenarios based on actual out-of-hospital medical scenes. Portions of the scenarios are altered to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. Hey, everybody. Welcome to EMS 2020. Today, both Spencer and I are super excited to welcome Dr. Seitz to our episode. One of the things you guys are going to discover about today's episode is that we have Dr. Seitz. He's going to introduce himself here in a little bit, talk about what he does and kind of how he came to have his interest in helping us paramedics. But the main thing that I think he is going to try to get across is that his word, or the word of any physician, is essentially the literal word of God, and it should be followed to a T. If I'm taking our conversation that we had prior to this correctly, that's what I got out of it.
We got to cut.
I think he misunderstood.
Ah, crap. So anyway, so yeah, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. We have Dr. Chris Seitz with us. Chris, go ahead and tell us about yourself.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm Dr. Chris Seitz. I'm an emergency physician. I'm based out in the Metro Detroit area. It's a little bit later here today than it is for you guys. Yeah. That's okay. I'm still awake, so we're good.
Hey, the world revolves around me, so.
So I actually worked in Detroit for a few years and did my training here. This is where I'm stationed at home. But I actually do travel medicine now. So I travel throughout the country to a lot of different states and fill in emergency departments that need the help. But my EMS interest has always been there. I actually grew up in an EMS family. My dad's a retired fire chief.
Oh, way cool.
Paramedic. My mother is a retired burn nurse, and my younger brother is a firefighter paramedic. So grew up in the EMS world and always had a passion for it. But then I think I saw one of my dad's W-2s, so I decided I'd try to do emergency medicine stuff. No, I'm just kidding. So anyway.
You're not just kidding. You're kidding, but you're totally not just kidding.
I think the kids call that kidding on the square.
Right. Correct. So I actually been involved in EMS for a long time. I did a little bit of flight medicine in residency and a lot of EMS education. So a few years back, my brother and I, like I said, he's a firefighter paramedic out here.
So he's a successful one.
Company. He's a successful one. Yes.
He's the one. He's the one your parents like. Okay.
Well, and actually you could say that because he's the one who has no debt. So, I mean, this whole plan could have backfired on me. I'm going to be honest.
So when you first said that, I could have sworn you just came in and said, well, he's the one that has no dad. And I'm like, I don't know how that works, because he's your brother. Like, but this podcast just
This is where my story takes a turn.
It's getting sad now.
He lives in a studio apartment, but he doesn't have any debt, so he's got that going for him.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So I don't know who's better off at this point. But anyway, we started a training company about 5 years ago. Sights and Sirens is our training company. Chris, you had kind of mentioned, I think, on your last podcast, yeah, we do a lot of national registry prep. So we do have a national registry prep program to help EMTs, AEMTs, and paramedics to get through that exam. And we're just super excited. We both obviously just have a huge passion for emergency medicine in general and pre-hospital care. And it's super fun to help others succeed in that. So if anybody is looking at that exam or they're looking to, like I said, to up their skills a little bit, you know, check us out. We've got some fun videos. We took all the educational standards, broke it down into easy to understand videos and workbooks and questions, so that you can kind of get everything you need in one spot. And like I said, help you get through that exam specifically. So that's my story. I'm happy to be here today. Like I said, looking for opportunities to get involved in education even more. And I appreciate you guys hosting me here.
Oh, we're totally happy to have you. And
Super stoked.
Yeah. And I'll point this out really quick too, is so Sights and Sirens, we're going to go ahead and we'll drop a link in the description. It'll be on our social media, so you guys can just go over there. I actually have to take the National Registry exam. So that's kind of one of the ways like this came to work out really well, is we actually kind of virtually bumped into each other, you know, social distancing, whatever, on one of the like NREMT groups. And, Dr. Seitz had contacted us. You know, we went and checked out Sights and Sirens. It was a perfect fit for what I had to do. And I signed up. And I just recently was able to kind of look at all of the videos that you guys have. And it is just a massive library of information that's on Sights and Sirens. And so it is, there are a lot of different programs out there, and I think they all have their use. But if you want that one, if you're just going to do one and you want to get there and you just want to pass and you want the no BS solution, go over to Sights and Sirens. If you need more, I guess check out the others. But Sights and Sirens is easy to use, and it has everything you're going to need. So I was super impressed when I went there. No, it's just...
Yeah, I was excited. I was excited when we saw you signed up. Actually, what we would like to do is for your guys' listeners, if you decide that we would be a good fit for your learning and study, you can put in the promo code EMS2020. And
awesome. Get 20% off. Do they need to do 20/20 or just 2020?
Just 2020.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, we'll drop that.
That's EMS2020.
Exactly. That is awesome. I'm just going to point out that I didn't get a discount, but hey.
I spent your money. I already spent your money, so you don't get... I'm sorry. There's no refund. No refunds for you.
Gotcha.
Other people maybe, but yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, that's even more incentive to go check it out. So go check it out. And I would say even if you're not taking a National Registry exam, there's just some good shit in there, man. I don't know if that's the kind of advertisement you want. Good shit in there, man.
Hey, but absolutely.
Yeah.
The best advertisement.
I get to take advantage of the 20% discount because it turns out Washington has lowered their KHEP requirements. And you just need an NREMT cert. And, also did the same math where I will let mine expire years back because I went, I'm not going to go anywhere. So
basically, someone lowered their standards so Spencer has a chance. It's like your marriage. All right. So, all right. So let's go ahead and get to the actual meat of the call here. So we're going to summarize. So as you guys know, we like to tell a story, then we like to do a deep dive. So let's talk about a podcast that's been super popular with you guys, and that was Critical Crossroads that we launched last week. So what happened in Critical Crossroads, we had Dingo and Corgi. Dingo, a more experienced senior medic. Corgi, a paramedic, but just not as senior. And they had this crossroads moment. So they responded to a facility, which... They responded there for abnormal lab values, code one, which means no lights and no sirens in this particular municipality. They responded there code one for abnormal lab values, which the facility did not have on hand. They weren't sure which ones were abnormal or not, which is super helpful when you're in this field. But they discovered a patient that abnormal lab values was not what they ended up really responding for. They responded to a patient ended up having some substantial difficulty breathing, and the crossroads they came to was, do I have a septic patient due to a recent history of pneumonia, and I'm going to be worried about things like adding fluid, or do I have a patient who has a history of congestive heart failure and now has pulmonary edema, where maybe adding a bunch of fluid isn't the best idea? Do I add CPAP? Do I not add CPAP? What ended up happening was that Corgi and Dingo couldn't ultimately decide exactly what they wanted to do. So they did nothing. They pretty much threw an oxygen mask on her. They actually smeared some aspirin in her face. Literally, if you haven't listened to the episode, go back and listen to it. Check it out. They did that. And the patient ends up coding on the way into the hospital. And so they went from a respiratory distress. Well, actually, they went from an abnormal lab values call to a code 99, but with respiratory distress in the middle. So, Spence, if you want to go ahead and state what our proposed treatment plan was at the time, and that'll kind of get everyone up to speed with what we thought should happen. Between the two of those choices, do you have congestive heart failure and want to limit fluids and start working on things like pressors, get that heart pumping again? Or do we have a septic patient that's going to need fluids, maybe pressors down the line, CPAP, no CPAP? What do we end up doing, Spence?
So basically, because the patient was extremely cyanotic and it was just drowning in fluid, and the non-rebreather was ineffective at fixing that, my proposal was, it doesn't really matter anymore what we have in terms of whether it's like pneumonia, fluid in the lungs from that, or if it's congestive heart failure and fluids backing up. I said, I don't really care what her pressure is at this point. It's high enough. Let's just put CPAP on it, even though it might break the protocol if they have the hard limit of 100 systolic. And then I said, get an IV, a few fluid challenges, being cognizant that she does have fluid in her lungs. And if her pressures drop too low, then, keep the CPAP, but continue with maybe add pressors to it, because oxygenation is a huge problem for this patient.
Yeah. So let's just base a little bit about CPAP. So one of the things that came up in the call that was a point of controversy was doing CPAP. So Corgi had auscultated the lungs and found lung sounds that he described as junky, which is kind of a trash term. It's not a trash term, but it doesn't focus in on, do we think we have you know, bronchi, which is more closely associated with pneumonia? Do we have RALS, which is more closely associated with pulmonary edema? The term junkie doesn't really determine. But regardless, one good way to get whatever that is out of the lungs is CPAP. Corgi was saying, hey, by protocol, this patient has a blood pressure of 92 over whatever, 92 systolic. By our protocol, that is too hemodynamically unstable to apply CPAP. The concern being that CPAP increases interthoracic pressure and can reduce cardiac output even further in someone who, according to Corgi, the part that he was at, already has a sick heart that isn't pumping blood the way it should be. So, Dr. Seitz, we're just kind of curious, where do you stand on CPAP for this patient?
Yeah, so when I listened to the case, actually the first thing I thought was like, oh man, like this patient needs CPAP.
Yeah.
And I get the protocol-driven component of it and the, you know, concern with dropping blood pressure. But in my mind, you know, I guess in my mind, when I first listened to it, I was like, well, what's the other option? Do nothing. And then they did nothing. So I was kind of like, oh, well, I mean, I guess that's another option. But, so like, you know what I mean? Like, protocols can only take you so far. I think CPAP would have been what I jumped on right away. When you got someone in respiratory distress, the short answer, I think I would jump on CPAP right away in that regard.
So let's talk about the blood pressure. So she has a blood pressure of 92 systolic.
I think their original one was 98.
Sorry, I got that wrong.
It's a little closer to the cutoff. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. But let's say for circumstance, since you know we're playing with the hypotheticals anyway, let's say it is 92.
Okay. All right. So, Dr. Seitz, it sounds like you're kind of on like the same page that Spencer and I are, which is, you know, pretty typical. I mean, we don't actually have the education you have, but I mean, pretty much. We've watched a lot of TV. We've Googled a lot of stuff. So I think we're there.
You bought my program. So
absolutely. Like, oh, yeah. So we're practically doctors.
It's everything I know. There's nothing left on the table. That's all I got. So
perfect. All right.
It's good enough, you know?
Gosh, you know, well, I think at this point, then you can leave. I mean,
I was surprised you guys invited me on in the first place. So, yeah, I'll just listen to the rest. So.
Sounds good. But hey, have you come across any studies or anything in your practice that would kind of lean one way or the other with CPAP with this patient?
Sure. So, and this is not clinically proven at this point, but like in my own practice, I've not seen CPAP like plummet people's blood pressures. So back to Spencer's point of like, let's try CPAP. You know, if the blood pressure starts to drop, then maybe we take them off CPAP. You know what I mean? Like, obviously that reevaluation of your patient piece is critically important. But
sure.
Like, just in my own practice, like I said, I'm not saying that. That's just my practice. So I'm not saying that that's pulled out. But so actually what I did is, you know, being the nerd that I am, when after this case, I was like, man, like, you know, I always like to go back to the literature, right? So if I don't know or if I'm not 100% sure, so it means I read a lot because I'm not ever 100% sure. But I went back to kind of the literature. I was like, what does the literature actually say about like CPAP, specifically when you're talking about sepsis? Because that was the concern, right? So, but some of the concern was like, well, but what if it's sepsis and her blood pressure is now low, et cetera, et cetera. So, so I actually found a couple different articles that I went through. So there was an article actually released in like 2012, and this was in the Intensive Critical Care Journal, titled Non-Invasive Ventilation in Community-Acquired Pneumonia and Severe Acute Respiratory Distress.
Oh, good.
So, like, literally, this patient, like, it literally is like, oh, okay, so this should answer all my questions. And what they kind of found was that, the end point of CPAP is, like, do they need intubation or do they not need intubation after CPAP? And what they found is actually that in patients with community-acquired pneumonia, who were in respiratory distress. So like we were thinking this patient might, and that had previous cardiac or respiratory diseases, like she did, that they actually responded better to things like CPAP than those who just had respiratory failure for other unknown reasons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, well that, you know, that's one study, right? And this was actually a review. So this was a few studies that they looked at to kind of like come up with this thing. But then in 2018, I found another article titled Management of Acute Respiratory Failure Due to a Community-Acquired Pneumonia. And they actually found that that non-invasive ventilation, so things like CPAP, showed substantial benefits in cases of COPD exacerbation, acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema, and lung infiltrates in immunosuppressed patients. Its prescription in community-acquired pneumonia remained uncertain because of the high treatment failure. But once again, like, it seemed to be a benefit overall. So, you know, based on this, like I said, I like to go back to the literature right there because then it just takes it out of my hands a little bit, right? So, like, yeah. According to these studies, if you look at it, I mean, like, CPAP would almost, you know, after reading these, like, be encouraged in this situation.
And I think so, too. I mean, from what I'm hearing, it almost sounds like the studies are saying – basically, your range is it may not make a difference to it may help. And to me, that's almost a no-brainer at that point.
Right. And that's the thing, too, is I think that, like, you have to ask yourself, like, what's the downside of letting this patient, like, continue to breathe the way she's breathing? And she's probably going to need to intubate it, right? She's probably going to need to be intubated.
That's very true.
Well, what if she put – what if we give her a bunch of fluids? What's the worst case that happened? Well, she get intubated, right?
Yeah.
What's the worst thing that could happen? I mean, like intubation becomes your endpoint for all of these things. And CPAP's really, you know, in this situation, the only thing that we can do to maybe prevent it. We still might end up there, right? But, you know, when I was listening to the case, I thought to myself, like, yeah, I mean, I think CPAP's all you got, right? I mean, like, I don't know what else I would do in this situation other than put her on some CPAP. And
I mean, I think really aside from CPAP, you're looking at RSI.
Right.
RSI, I mean, really, she needs positive pressure ventilation, and how she's going to get that, I think is the only thing you're really going to change. And I think that's kind of why Spencer and I both jumped on CPAP, because it's going to provide a little extra pressure for her and keep those alveoli open as she tries to breathe and hopefully kind of keep her off the tube. But now as I sit here talking to you, I'm kind of wondering, was there ever really a chance to keep this patient off the tube in the first place? And was RSI in the field indicated?
So I don't think, I mean, and that's actually, because I actually shared the case with a couple of my colleagues while I was getting ready for the follow-up. And a couple of them, before we even got to the case, they're like, intubator, tube down there. You know, it's just like the first thing, which obviously is much easier for us, right? I mean, like, there's a difference between intubating with the bed up to your, you know, brought up to your chest by a nurse and the patient, you know, sedated versus like trying to like, you know, get behind the toilet to put it to, you know, it's just, I get that it's different, right?
Or like, in some facility where we're like, we fit 17 people into a condo. Can you come, you know?
Can you come figure this out? Yeah. So, I mean, like, so it's much easier for us to say, you know what, let's do intubation. But yeah, I mean, I think that would have been an option. I mean, I think definitely, like, if you have the protocol and you feel comfortable with the protocol for RSI, then yeah, I mean, like I said, so, you know, and part of that is too, is again, like, what's going to happen, you know, in the end, no matter what. And really in all these cases, so if she's septic, then she's going to get intubated. If she's got a CHF exacerbation, she may need to get intubated if CPAP doesn't work. If she, I mean, like in this, and obviously if you're going to do nothing, then yeah, she's probably going to need to be intubated too. So it's kind of, you know, I don't think it would have been a
problem. Right.
So yeah, so I think RSI and intubation would not have necessarily been a bad call. I don't know if I would have jumped on that right away, only because you do have CPAP. So we could have tried, you know, you could try CPAP first and it doesn't work. Or if it, you know, if it does tank the pressure, take her off. And I think this patient inevitably is going to need intubation at some point. If we can't reverse her, and we obviously have limited resources to reverse her due to her current clinical status.
Here's a question for you. My plan would have been, because I don't really have, other than RSI, which comes with its own host of, you know, of potential downsides, especially out in the field.
Absolutely.
I don't have anything else to really oxygenate the patient with. And so, like, I'm loath, like, if this were me and I were playing this scenario, and, you know, I were Dingo or Corgi, probably Dingo, because I also would leave kits behind.
nice.
I would want to keep her on the CPAP and then use fluids and pressors to keep her pressures up to maximize oxygenation.
And my thought is, like, ultimately, like, if I take her off the CPAP and her oxygen sats plummet, now I'm, you know, now I'm really doing, like, an emergent RSI instead of, like, that kind of calmer, you know, like, all right, well, you know, like, let's try and get her, you know, like, now I'm trying to, you know, intubate her before her sats drop into the 60s. You know, that would be my fear. What are your thoughts on that? It would, you know, pressors to support CPAP if it does drop her blood pressure?
Sure. You know? So, I mean, and that's the game you're playing, right? So you're trying to optimize her oxygenation without tanking her pressures, which also bring them back up. So kind of what you guys had suggested before too, I think is what I would have done. Now, let me like give the caveat here that like I know you were teasing in the beginning that like what I say, I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here. Unfortunately, yeah. Other than what they did, which was nothing. I mean, I really think that like maybe we should have done something, but there is no, I think doing something and doing your best in this kind of situation is like I think everybody wants to think of you know, the science of medicine, and we forget about the art of medicine, which is the fact that, you know, we don't have all the answers. And if you know, even if you find a physician who says, oh, you should absolutely do this, question that, right? Because I just don't think there's very many absolutes when you get into like this kind of more critical care medicine stuff. Yeah. So yeah, I think that, like I said, I would have put her on CPAP. And then if her blood pressures started to go down, I would have given her a little bit of fluid, maybe supported with pressors. But I think the CPAP, in my opinion, in this case, is probably the most important piece. I think that may have, and I can't say, right? Monday morning quarterbacks can be easier, but I can't say for certain that would have prevented her from going to cardiac arrest, but perhaps. And that's you know, important.
And I think kind of one of the things that I would kind of like to point out is it seems like the medic crew is really hung up on this hypotension point. Corgi seemed really concerned about that getting worse. But one of the points I'd like to point out is that, yeah, hypotension is bad. So is hypoxia. And so you have to figure out, this patient is clearly hypoxic. I mean, barring every other thing as to like why you thought she got there, her sats are low, she's blue, she's struggling to breathe, she's hypoxic. That has to be corrected. So you got to figure out, how are you going to correct that hypoxia? And I think that's where there was a little bit of a breakdown, because at the end of the day, you got to oxygenate her. And you can do that with CPAP. You can do that with, I mean, a non-rebreather, but not very well, apparently, in this case. Or you can RSI this patient. And so I think that was kind of one of the things that maybe Corgi was missing in this call, is that while Corgi was really concerned about hypotension, and rightfully so, hypotension is bad, Corgi, I think, was missing the point of hypoxia in there as well. I wasn't thinking about fixing the hypoxic patient.
Well, let me hop in and play devil's advocate real quick.
Oh, please do.
I'll put myself in Corgi's situation. So he was worried that their blood pressure was too low for them. So he, you know, he, in his mind, he was thinking like, okay, she's in, you know, she's going into cardiogenic shock. And per their protocol, if they're in cardiogenic shock, you start pressors with the blood pressure being as low as it was.
And he thought it was lower because it was low for her, because she's normally hypertensive.
And just to recap really quick, if you guys recall, Dingo did have a blood pressure log that showed this patient typically rides 150s, 160s systolic. So that's what Corgi was comparing to. And Corgi saw that, then saw what she was at, and was like, huh, something's up.
So for I'm guessing in his mind, because I'm not Corgi, so I don't know, but I, based on sort of his actions, this is like the most charitable interpretation of it, is he went like, oh God, this must be like her 98 must be like my 78 or, you know, or something along those lines.
I think it's exactly what he was thinking.
He was thinking it was incredibly low.
Yeah. And so I don't I hear that said a lot. Both in pre-hospital and in the emergency department setting, like, oh, this is, you know, quote unquote low for them. I don't really know if that's a thing. So first of all, I've never seen any clinical data to suggest that like someone's blood pressure is on a different scale because they normally run high. You know what I mean? Like someone who runs in the 200s, you know, if they drop out on the 120s, I'm not putting them on pressors. I've never had to do that. I've never, they're still perfusing perfectly fine. So I don't know if the body actually works that way. I get the idea behind it. I don't know if that's actually something that we can say for true, because then to like take that to the extreme, right? Like if your blood pressure is normally 250, like are you in cardiac arrest when you're at like 70?
Right.
I don't think so, right? You still have blood pressure. So at some point it's got to like margin out, you know what I mean? So I do hear that said a lot, and I just, it's not something I necessarily buy into. And like I said, anybody's free to correct me if I'm wrong. I always tell people like, hey, like bring me the data, right? Like bring me the study, bring me the, you know, and some people do sometimes, and it's awesome. I mean, I love that. So, but like I said, I don't know if that's, I've never seen that actually play out as like,
you know, making such a, I think that maybe it makes sense from like a pathophysiological standpoint. Does it make sense clinically? I don't think it does personally.
I think it's one of those things where like, I understand the idea. I mean, I understand saying like, hey, they normally ride in the 150s and 160s. So either they acutely cured their own hypertension and they're now riding lower and that's normal, or something's wrong. So I think I understand the concept of, hey, this is indicating that something is up, maybe, because it's a clearly different blood pressure trend than what they normally have. But whether or not you should change your treatments on that, or whether or not you can honestly come up and say, hey, they're no longer perfusing, I think that's where that line is people assume that these patients are like unable to perfuse at a lower pressure. And I think that's the mistake.
And that's, I mean, that's a super good point, especially in the sense of like, you know, someone is normally in like the 180s and I don't give them blood pressure medicine and they drop down in the 120s. I might ask him how they're feeling, right? Like, hey, are you feeling okay? And that sort of thing. Just like, I mean, the same thing, like, you know, someone who's in the 180s and we give them blood pressure medicine and now they're in the 110s and we're like, okay, stop taking your blood pressure medicine. No, we don't do that, right? That's not what we do, because it's not how it actually works. So I agree. I think it can definitely be used as a clinical clue, knowing your patient's normal state and range. Which actually, like a quick tangent here, but what's super interesting is that if you actually look at, I don't know why, but at one point I went back and looked at like the original studies of like how we got ranges of, you know, heart rate,
blood pressure,
all this kind of stuff. And they took, this is true, especially for heart rates, 60 to 100, they took like a large group of 20-year-old white men and figured out what their heart rates were. And then that became the standard.
Oh, wow.
So, like, you know, is that everyone's standard? Probably not. I mean, like, so, you know, these kind of things, you actually have to take that in consideration. So knowing your patient's baseline and how far they are from their baseline obviously is super important when it comes to, you know, clinical practice. But again, when it comes to like perfusion and pressors and all these kind of, you know, protocol driven things, maybe we need to be a little more careful just saying like, oh, well, for them, this must mean something completely different, because I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Yeah. And you know, it's kind of funny. This has been a point of contention amongst some of our listeners ever since we did amputee with an AMI, where we have a paramedic who deferred nitro due to what they perceived to be a low blood pressure for this patient, but was otherwise indicated. So, no, it's kind of good to revisit this and weigh in there.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, Spence, I rudely cut you off. And then again, wow, I'm on a roll. Perfect. Yeah,
wow. Okay. So in this case, one of the
medics, not going to interrupt you anymore. It's just getting rude at this point.
We're just going to...
Everyone just piled right on.
I'm like, Spencer, shh, quiet. Hold on. I gotta say something else. Go ahead. Sorry.
I wasted a day of sobriety. In this case, one of the medics wanted to use pressors right away because the blood pressure was low for the patient. So I think the conclusion I'm hearing from that, or the kind of consensus that both of you are coming to, is that, yeah, that's probably not really the right thing to do here. The more correct thing to do would have just been go right to the CPAP.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. And I honestly, too, and like I said, the data, I think, supports this a little bit. I never give pressors unless I've started with fluids, even if it's a little bit of fluids. I mean, like, I got to know that the blood pressure is not going to come up with fluids before I start putting pressors on board. Pressors, yeah. I mean, everything we do has consequences, and pressors, obviously, you guys know, have a lot of consequences. So I'm a little less eager to jump on pressors immediately. You know, like I said, I think if it was Corgi who wanted to start the pressors, you know, starting with a little 250cc bolus first to see if that does anything, is not going to harm the patient so drastically that you're going to not be able to put the pressors on after the fact.
Yeah. I'll throw a little stick in the spokes here really quick, not to change direction too much, but hypothetically, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just interesting thought here. Let's say the blood pressure was 102. Would you drop nitro? She's got chest pain. Blood pressure technically meets that systolic line.
I personally wouldn't.
I don't think I would either.
Mainly because like I said, I'm not seeing CPAP drop people's pressures too aggressively. I've seen nitro drop people's pressures pretty aggressively. I know she was complaining of chest pain. That being said, like I said, I think in this kind of case, because everyone's thinking along the lines of like, is this cardiogenic shock from like CHF versus sepsis? You know, which one of these? you know, nitroglycerin in an acute MI is going to dilate those vessels and bring oxygen to the heart. I don't think that's really what her underlying issue is here. I think it's either fluid overload or it's sepsis, which would be more of a distributive shock on top of a cardiogenic shock. So I don't know if nitro really is going to play that big of a role and might just complicate things more for me.
And I bring that up specifically because an amputee with an AMI, like nitro was withheld because of a borderline blood pressure there. But I think the big critical difference here is an amputee with an AMI, there was no sepsis, wasn't even on the radar. I mean, it wasn't, there was no indication for that whatsoever. And I think adding in sepsis as a possible path to take on this, like I would just hate to have a septic patient that's already systemically dilated and then drop nitro on that patient and be like, awesome, now I'm going to fight my own,
like,
you know.
You and personally, I feel like you got to look at it in the whole clinical picture. And I think sometimes we get hung up on the protocols because thinking about starting pressors, starting nitroglycerin probably is not also in the same. You know what I mean? Like, you got to pick one. I mean, I don't, it, honestly, in these kind of cases, like it doesn't, maybe doesn't really matter what you pick. I mean, obviously it does, but like, it's okay to say, hey, I just don't know. I'm going to follow this train of thought until I get more data and I can change it. But like, I got to pick one to start with. Right. Like, so I'm not going to like, I'm like, put this nitro in, I'm going to push this epi and give me some fluids and I'm going to, you know, I don't know. So.
And go ahead and mix that insulin into a bag of D25. Thanks. Right. Now let's go ahead and start administering that. That'd be great. Sorry, Smith, go ahead.
I'm just going to keep playing this role of devil's advocate. Let's say they had another piece of information that they missed, which was somebody came in holding that, like, you know, like Charlie in the Chocolate Factory is like, I've got the golden ticket, except instead of the golden ticket, it's the actual lab values that were remiss.
The basic thing that facility should add. Gotcha.
Here's the thing that we called you for. I found it.
That'd be amazing.
You win, Charlie. What if it was the BMP and it read like 1400? You know, so it's just another, I guess, like stronger indicator for like, oh, she's just in like super congestive heart failure. And like,
I think even with that lab value, it doesn't really. So, you know, I always teach students, medical students specifically too, because we spend a lot of time looking at lab values in the ER. Like, you still have to treat your patient, not the labs, right? So you don't, you know, I'm not convinced. Even if you told me, hey, she was full on septic, I would say, yeah, and probably also in pulmonary edema, cardiogenic shock, because, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Like, did she become septic, which then exacerbated her CHF? Did she, I mean, like, so a BNP reading 1400, I don't think would really change anything because I still wouldn't be convinced that she wasn't septic and that was causing the congestive heart failure and pulmonary edema. So, again, I don't know. I don't think that would really change. And like I said, again, you know, brain natriuretic peptide, which is what the BNP is, you know, released from, you know, heart tissue muscle when it's, you know, starved and that sort of thing. Not like a troponin, but like I said, you can kind of think about it some ways in that. So still nitroglycerin, the point of nitroglycerin is to dilate the coronary vessels for a short period of time. Right, I never give nitroglycerin to CHF unless they're hypertensive, in which case I'm trying to decrease preload. I don't need to decrease this patient's preload because she's already maybe a little hypotensive. So, you know what I mean? So I think nitroglycerin probably wouldn't play a factor in the way I would have approached it.
Okay.
Excellent. That's I'm glad I'm in line. I don't have that all, you know, as squared away in my head, but I kind of have this like, I don't really want to give nitro to this person. I don't know why, but I don't.
Right.
And I actually will say too, sorry, really quick, one of the things, because you had mentioned like they didn't have the lab value. This actually happens a lot. And I'll tell you why it happens. So what happens is the physician is not in these places, right?
No, they're not.
Maybe comes in like once a week and like, it's like, oh, did grandma die? I don't know. He doesn't even know when, like, you know, he doesn't know what's going on. It really, and like, that's not anyone's fault. And I liked, Chris, how you had mentioned last week about like the LPN, like getting mad at these people, like, one, even if it was because they were in, you know, inept, is not going to do you or the patient any good. So it's kind of, you know, a silly waste of energy. But usually, I mean, like, it's not.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's usually that these people are don't know what they're doing. They are not, they don't have resources. They don't have support. They, you know, I mean, it's not an ideal work environment from a medical standpoint in a lot of these places. And that's not even necessarily their fault either because of funding issues, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens is these doctors come in and they'll order lab values. They'll come back 2 days later and the doc will just get it like in an email to himself. And he'll just call up the facility and say, hey, send, you know, Grandma Jane to the emergency department. Her labs are off. Click. He doesn't even tell them what the labs were that were on. He's the only one that has them. So a lot of times I'll get these patients that come in. I'll get the lab values before the facility does because I know which doctor to call who got them to his office. I mean, it's a whole kind of messed up system. But yeah, that's kind of why a lot of times these people have no idea what the lab values are because they were never told or given either.
All right. So, but Dr., we still have this on scene conflict. We still have these two paramedics kind of wondering like where they should go. What are your thoughts on like OLMC for a situation like this and being able to move forward with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got two medics. They're both thinking, you know, a very different way. And there's obviously that the whole conflict there. So, you know, either they're both wrong, which is unlikely, right? They're both trained paramedics. I mean, yeah. It'd be harder for there to be a third option that the two of them didn't think of, right? Or one of them is right and one of them is very wrong. Mm-hmm. Or they're both right, which in this case, they're both kind of right.
Yeah.
So, and then unfortunately, instead of one of them saying, hey, you know what? Yeah, I get what you're saying. Let's just try this, though. They both just kind of like throw their hands up. And I think like, you know, I think we have to be really careful. If you want to realize that, like, you don't know everything, just, like, keep learning. Because, like I said, the more you learn, especially in medicine, I mean, the more you realize it, like, oh, wow, so we just have no idea. You know what I mean? Like, that's sure. What it feels like sometimes. It's like, so, you know, I think this is actually a great opportunity. If they were really that, and one question I'll actually pose back to you guys is, because you guys are actually in the field, but,
sure.
You know, usually there's a lead medic. So the fact that the lead medic in this case didn't say, hey, no, I get what you're saying, but this is what we're going to do. I'm the lead tech. I'm the tech medic or whatever. This is what we're going to do. The fact that he didn't say that makes me wonder how sure he was about his point. And then again, like, did we just bury our heels into the ground just because we didn't want to be wrong? And does that really serve the patient? I'm not really sure.
I'm kind of with you on that. I think, as a lead medic, like, I think there was probably an opportunity for Dingo to kind of be like, hey, like, I hear you, let's move on. And so I'm wondering the same thing you are, is was Dingo as sure as maybe he portrayed? Maybe he wasn't sure about this.
Right. Well, and if you get to these situations, actually, Spencer, go ahead, because I want to hear what you had to say, too, about it.
I was going to say, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine
not
long ago, also a paramedic. Yeah, true story. Also a paramedic. We'll give him the code name Q-Tip. And it was a long conversation, but I'll give you the tip.
Give us just the tip.
So I think everybody, this is sort of a universal like human experience. And this is kind of why I like doing the show, is because we're like, we get to talk about very like universal things for paramedics, and I think they just apply broadly. And everybody in every profession really wants to just feel like competent, intelligent, and like respected, like they know what they're doing. And a lot of times people sort of do this the wrong way, which is they're like, they don't want to admit they're wrong because admitting they're wrong or admitting they don't know feels like weakness. But you know, it feels like, oh man, I'm telling the world, I'm announcing to the world, like I just don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Or you're announcing to the world, I'm liable. Like that's...
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so, you know, one of his points, and this is sort of a sneakier point, is like, you know, to get people to think that you're competent and intelligent is you should listen to their ideas and compliment them when they're right, you know, and like, or like even the fact that they're thinking about something, you're just like, man, you put a lot of thought into that. And then, interestingly enough, people respond positively to that, and they go like, oh, he thinks I'm smart. He's kind of an intelligent guy. And here's the thing, like, I do this a lot because I need to, which is, when I'm like, oh yeah, I'm like interpreting a 12 lead or whatever, I'm like, I think it's this, but I could be wrong.
And then when I'm wrong, I still get to claim a little bit of partial credit, but it, because I was right that I was wrong.
Yeah, right.
I was like, well,
I told you
this,
so. I told you.
Yeah, maybe right. I'm wrong. but here's the thing, like, I think this is sort of the beauty of it. Like, even if you're doing it for these sort of like nefarious reasons, you know, like, oh, I'm going to go in there and try and like, those are all actually like, they're all attributes of like a more intelligent person, you know, like being open to being wrong, listening to other people's ideas, you know, just a little bit of humility. Like all of those are actually really good traits. And I think had those been employed here, the outcome may have been different. I could be wrong, but
you know, nice. You worked it in right there.
Oh, I see what you did there.
This is like,
okay, yeah, I'm picking it up now.
It's like conversational inception. It's amazing.
but you know, they basically just went like, "Well, I'm not wrong, so you are," and then like nobody did anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is too is like, and this is obviously like not something that necessarily would happen, but you think to yourself too, like neither of these guys learned anything then either, right? Like
true.
They were both a little bit right, but they were also both a little bit wrong. And even us talking about it, I'm probably a little bit wrong and a little bit right. Like we may never have the answers to those questions because we're never going to be able to dissect every single patient case and know exactly what was happening inside their body and how we could have handled it differently. But the fact that neither of them learned anything, like it's almost like how many more patients like this have to die before, you know what I mean? Cause like what yeah. happens if these guys go on the same run next week and the week after that and the week, cause like, you're going to see this patient. I mean, I've seen this patient before. You're going to see this patient. And, you know, hopefully these two guys don't get the same call again because it's probably not the same outcome, right? I mean, right, if you want, yeah. Yeah, at some point, you know, like you've got to – and even with your patients, and I think this is even harder for people, but even with your patients, admitting to your patients when you're wrong actually has been shown in the literature to save you from – being sued and that sort of thing. That's actually, they've actually looked at the, you know, doctors, you know, obviously I'm talking about doctors here because we get sued a lot, but, so I mean, that's why I'm doing podcasts and not working in the hospital right now. No, I'm just kidding. But no, you know what I mean? Like they actually say like the more just like open you are, but hey, you know what? Like, I'm so sorry. Like that was a mistake. I'm gonna do everything I can to fix it. Like people understand that you're human. When you pretend you're not human, that's when people get pissed and want to sue you. I mean, that's oh, just wow. kind of like, you know, the bottom line. So yeah, it's very interesting.
That's a good point yeah. to make.
I think one of the things that they could have done to roadblock this, going back to your a point you brought up, is like online medical control, you know, like might have been a good solution here, you know, calling up a doctor and saying
definitely.
Like, hey.
And that's one thing that like I like to encourage a lot because I mean, it's literally what it's there for. I mean, and I think sometimes it goes back to Spencer, kind of what you said with like, they don't want to be wrong. So why would you call medical control? Because then they're going to, but what they probably would have found in this case is that the medical control, you know, I would have answered the phone and they would have told me the case and I would have been like, oh yeah, no, I have no idea. Just put them on CPAP or something and bring them here. You know what I mean? Cause I'm not going to have a good answer for you either. And then you're going to realize, oh, okay, we are both right a little bit and we can feel more comfortable doing at least one yeah. of them and trying our best, you know? I mean, I think that's okay.
There are a lot of paramedics that I've talked to, especially newer paramedics, who are really intimidated about like calling up and, you know, like sounding like a dumbass to a doctor, you know, like, yeah. especially if they're like taking the patient to that hospital to their, you know, then meet that doctor. I have said some just incredibly, you know, in retrospect, like dumb shit over online medical control, you know, like, is this the right thing to do here? You know, and, you know, like everybody has always been very gentle. You know, they're like, you know, like I think usually I say like, I know what I'm asking and I start with like, hey, I'm calling you because of this. So that kind of puts, you know, the doctor I'm talking to in like the frame of mind where they're like, okay, he's asking me for a very specific thing, or okay, he's calling to like ask me a story, you know, to tell me a story and say like, hey, you know, just help me.
well, actually, going back to your point before, like yeah. you call a doctor as a medic and you say, hey, listen, like, I just have no idea. And you're basically telling them, like, I know you're smarter. And they're like, oh, well, hey, let me help you then because you think I'm smart. You know what I mean? Kind of goes back to that same thing you were bringing up before. Like, it works. It's okay. Like, it, you know, are you going to get the one douchebag who's, like, been up since, like, you know, all day and it's 2 a.m. and he's pissed and he's just going to be a dick over the – yeah, it's going to happen. He's not going to remember your name, though, because he's a dick. So,
right. Exactly. Or he'll wake up the next morning and it's like, was I a dick to that guy over the phone?
I don't know. Who cares? I'm going to sleep.
You know, so I kind of want to pull it back to another good point that OLMC brings up. And I think it's something we touched on in the original episode as well. When it comes to getting stuck on a crossroad, data is your friend. And OLMC is kind of a form of data, right? I mean, you're basically presenting data to another doctor so they can then relay more data back to you in terms of what they're thinking. I also feel pretty strongly there was a missed opportunity to grab data in this call as they were moving the patient from the patient's room out of the labyrinth of a facility all the way back to their ambulance. And at some point, the patient went from a blood pressure of 92 systolic to zero. And we never got a blood pressure in between. And I think we should probably bring up the point about just kind of before we end this here, I think we really need to bring up the point of the importance of reassessment and trending your patient that was probably missed in this. And I mean, in my opinion, there was probably a stopgap between decent blood pressure and dead that got missed.
Yeah, it's rare that I go from, you know, somebody who's like, I'm hovering around 98 to just zero. Just
yeah.
Rant. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think patients dying on you is really an easy miss situation.
Which sounds like it shouldn't be. It sounds like it shouldn't be.
Really, but it is. It feels like it shouldn't be.
Hopefully lay people don't listen to your guys' podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, they do, actually. We have a lay people's
podcast. No, I'm just kidding. No, but it is. Like, it seems like it shouldn't be. And it's just like, wait, what? Yeah, but you're right. You're right.
But a lot of that is, I think, partially because of, like, there's tunnel vision on those critical calls. An example of this, and one I encountered recently, is just like airway management gone poorly. You know, the medic is so close to getting the tube and they just can't get that ET tube through the cords and they're almost there. And then, but like, meanwhile, the patient's saturations have dropped precipitously. They've bradied down. And, you know, by the time they secure the tube, they're now in a PEA arrest, you know, and then that's when the medic finally either abandons the attempt or they succeed and then realize they're like, all right, I got the tube. Shit, I need to start CPR.
Oh, man.
And so, like, here in this case, you know, like, they were focused on getting the patient down the hall, past the Minotaur, outside, and into the rig. And, like, that was probably, like, there were, you know, kits that had to be carried out. There's, you know, like, the patient who's on the gurney, on the non-rebreather, and, like, everybody's just trying to get her out there quickly and get her to the hospital, and not a single person is probably watching her for her vitals. And it's not willful, like, you know, like, they weren't doing that willfully. Just, like, they probably thought, like, oh, the other person's watching her. Like, we're just pushing the stretcher, you know, and that's sort of how those things happen. And, you know, like, so nobody really knows when she died, right? I mean, like,
right.
Maybe she forgot to announce it.
Hey, guys, I'm going under.
But I mean, that's the thing is, you know, it's quiet on these critical patients, especially in situations where we have a lot going on. In our, you know, like, pre-record session, we had talked about, like, capnography for monitoring. And Dr. Seitz, you are, man, soulmates with me, buddy. Like, I'm with you. Capnography for monitoring.
Should I leave now? Is this your guys' podcast now?
Yeah, that's going? Your turn to leave, right? No, for sure. And I think, like you mentioned, the blood pressure. I mean, obviously, like, reassessment. I mean, I think we miss a lot of opportunities here. We talk about gathering more information, and your reassessment piece is so important here. And, you know, really quickly going back, like, you're going to put her on CPAP, you worry about blood pressure. Well, just monitor the blood pressure. If you're worried about giving her fluids and her blood pressure, you're worried about pressure. I mean, like, you've got, you know, the more data points you have, the more, you know, our job is not to stabilize a patient, it's to keep them stabilized. And you're not going to know about decompensation unless you're reassessing quite often. And capnography is just such a non-invasive, awesome tool. exactly for this? Like, because the question is, like, did she die in the back of the ambulance? And when I say die, I mean, like, did she lose a pulse in the back of the ambulance? Or did she lose a pulse when they were wheeling her down the hallway or when they were loading her in? Or, you know, that becomes the question. You just don't know. And even blood pressure takes some time to, like, cycle and that sort. But capnography doesn't. So capnography is going to give you a waveform until she stops breathing, and then you're not going to have an waveform anymore. So you're going to notice that she stopped breathing probably before she even lost the pulse.
At least your monitor is going to get really noisy about it. You know, and
right, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I think that's a really, that's an awesome point to bring up, because like you said, like blood pressure, if you have it set to repeat, it'll repeat. But a lot of EMS monitors either don't have the function or it's set at like Q15. So you're only going to see it every 15 minutes. Pulse oximeters are notoriously fall off people's fingers, especially after you move them over. And this lady was in a PEA. So the EKG's automatic, like, hey, the heart rhythm per the ECG is too low, wouldn't have kicked in because she was in a PEA. And it's one of those things where the heart monitor is going to see electrical. So the only indicator they could have added that would have automatically said, not that you should rely on automatic alarms, not what I'm saying in EMS, but the only thing that would have kicked in had they had capnography is the moment she went apneic, the apnea alarm would have popped off. They would have gotten that beeping tone and someone would have stared a little bit sooner. Again, not that you should rely on tones, you should be looking at your patient. But again, like, NTOT would have been one more piece of data.
Too, like, and like Spencer said, it can be so quiet. Is that like your patient can be breathing really heavily, then not breathing heavily, and then be apneic, and you could be watching her and you don't know. I mean, sometimes you need those monitoring tools.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, that happens as well. And I still think capnography, for whatever reason, is just so much more underutilized than it could be. So, like, I'm a huge advocate for continuous capnography monitoring in any patient with respiratory issues.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not the norm. I mean, like, we teach it for intubation. Obviously, we teach it for CPR. And even then, sometimes it's hard for me to convince the nurses and to put it on the patient. But literally, I think all your COPD patients, all your CHF patients, I think we should be using continuous capnography. It gives us so much more data than a pulse ox does. And that real time, I mean, when you're trying to ventilate a patient, an oxygenated patient, I mean, that ventilation piece kind of has to come first, right? So it gives you that in real time. As soon as that waveform disappears, you're not ventilating anymore. And you know it immediately. You're not waiting for that pulse ox to drag down to, you know, below 90 after the blood circulated five times because there's more oxygen on the hemoglobin than we were unloading. You know what I mean? Like, it just really gives you a lot more data. So,
and there is the literal word of God from Dr. Chris Seitz himself. Like, let's shoot you there.
I pulled it off in the end.
I could be wrong, but that sounds amazing.
Could be wrong.
I think the only other thing I would just kind of like to drive home is we did get a few comments about, you know, Spencer and I kind of straddled that. Spencer and I, we came up with a treatment plan that didn't really fit any one protocol in the scenario. And that's kind of one last point I want to make is that you can't write a protocol for every single patient out there. It's not possible to do. And you're going to have these patients that kind of straddle the protocol. This is why it's important as a paramedic to know more than just what's in your book. You know, a lot of states now require an associate's degree. There's A&P that goes along with it. And this is why that's important, because sooner or later, you're going to come to the patient that doesn't fit a protocol, and you're just going to have to go on your own clinical knowledge and start clinically justifying your treatments. And, you know, I mean, I hope Dr. Seitz backs me up on this, but if you vary from protocol and you have a solid clinical reason when you arrive at the ER and you give that clinical reason to a physician, you're going to be solid. You'll be fine. I've never gotten to a physician and been like, hey, look, I know the line for CPAP is 100. They had a systolic of 98. I put them on the CPAP and they got a lot better. And now their pressure's better because, you know, they're no longer hypoxic. I've never heard of a physician being like, yeah, but you did break a rule. It's never happened to me.
Well, no, and it's not going to happen. And mainly because we have no idea what your protocol is.
That's fair.
I mean, like, if I'm being completely honest, like 99% of the ER doctors you run into have no idea what your protocols are. They've probably even asked you, like, why didn't you do this? And you're like, we don't even carry that medication. What is he talking about? I mean, like, exactly. We don't know. I mean, like, half these guys don't know, if not more. So, and that's very normal. But yeah, I mean, like, where you're going to get in trouble is if you deviate from a protocol that you didn't follow to begin with, right? I mean, you can only deviate from something that you're following. So if you don't know what you're following, you can't deviate from it. Or if you don't know why you're deviating from it, right? I mean, like, if you don't know, if you can't give me a reason why you did those things that were out of protocol, well, then, yeah, we probably have a problem. But, yeah, I mean, if you're working in the best interest of the patient and you're like, hey, this is what I was thinking, even if you were thinking wrong, that's okay. I mean, like, at least you were, like, you were coming down a – even if it's the wrong path, as long as you're going down that path, it's when you're going down a path that no one can explain and even you can't. That's when you know, maybe run into some issues. But, yeah, and I think, like I said, I mean, I think this patient could have gone on CPAP right away. A little bit of a fluid bolus. If you started seeing pressure start to really drop, you could start the pressors. I think all those things would have been perfectly fine, and you could justify all of them. You could have justified RSI and intubating this patient as well. You know, could you justify doing nothing? Well, actually, that might get you in a little bit of trouble too. So, like I said, I think that, like, you know, not always, but sometimes doing something's better than doing nothing, especially in these cases, and just understanding what you're doing and why is more important than what exactly the protocol says. Because as you said, we can only write protocols that are going to fit every case, and patients don't fit every case that we write in the textbooks and things like that. They just don't. And just like this patient didn't. So that's kind of where you're at.
Well, Dr. Seitz, all I can say is thank you for joining us on this. I think we've done a great job of kind of going over the episode and really kind of bringing it out and, you know, making our, ramblings have, I don't know, maybe a little bit more validity behind them. So everyone who listens, please go ahead and check out Sights and Sirens. We're going to drop a link in the description to get there. Use the promo code EMS2020 if you're interested in signing up for a discount. Again, like, it's a lifesaver for me because I have to take that National Registry exam coming up, and it's been about 15 years since I've taken it. So, yeah, I could use a little extra info. Even if you're not taking it, there's information on there that's awesome for you. So please check out Sights and Sirens. Link in the description below. Promo code is EMS 2020. And with that, does anyone else have anything else they want to add before we button this up?
No, I just want to thank you guys so much for having me on. And like I said, I'd love to come back sometime if I can ever get that medical license reinstated.
Right. As long as the family drops the charges, we should be set. I'll put out the invitation. Dr. Seitz, you're welcome back anytime. You hear an episode you want to comment on, you just let us know and you're on. That's it.
I appreciate it.
With that, check us out on Facebook at EMS2020. We're on Instagram at EMS2020 Show. Go ahead and shoot us an email at EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. Oh, Dr. Seitz, did you have a Facebook group starting?
We do, actually. Yeah. So we just started a quick Facebook group. So it's Sights and Sirens NREMT Prep. And, you know, the reason we started that is that I want you guys to have, if you're studying for that exam especially, but if you have any kind of medical questions from the pre-hospital standpoint, not only myself, but a lot of our other educators are monitoring that page to answer medical questions, not so that you don't understand them, but so that you can actually use the information out in the field. So if you have any medical questions at all, feel free to join us there and pose your questions and hopefully get some answers from we'll call ourselves experts, but
perfect.
That's just for the page. So,
all right. Well, awesome. We'll have to check that out. We'll have to be on that group as well. It sounds awesome. So, Spence, do you want to just awkwardly close on the show like you do every time?
No.
That's fair. All right. See you guys next week.